It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening, every day is Halloween, isn't it? For some of us.
Oh, that wasn't great, was it? Right. So, I'm going to tell you a story of a guy called Steve Wilkins, and a lot of the research for this was taken from a True Detective magazine in an article written by A.W. Moss, who seems to have the majority of the facts of the case. So, Steve Wilkins was born in 1953, and he lived with his parents in Grimsby. And we literally could have made a whole episode just based on what he did as a teenager. Because at age 14 in 1967, Stephen was all over the newspapers because he had like a Catch Me If You Can style escapade.
No, I love Catch Me If You Can.
I was going to say, have you seen this one? I love that film.
But if you haven't seen it, it's Leonardo DiCaprio. But it's a true story, isn't it?
Mm.
And he's just, the best bit for me is he goes to a new school and he walks into the class and everyone's looking at him and sort of staring, and then he just starts teaching it.
And they, yeah, they
and
go
then he's
with
like,
it.
Year 10.
That's how easy it is to be
and
a
does it for
supply
like
teacher.
3 months, doesn't it?
But yeah, so he did something quite similar. But the Frank Abagnale, who's from the film, did all sorts. He pretended to be an airline pilot, he pretended to be a doctor, and really successfully for ages.
Yeah.
So Stephen, again, he was only age 14 at the time, and he said to his parents that he wanted to go and have a life at sea. And so he just sort of ran away from home and started hitchhiking towards London. He eventually made his way to Heathrow Airport, where he managed to get past security unnoticed and onto the runway. And I was just thinking, like, basically, I then went in this little weird stream of consciousness as I was making notes. And I was like, if you weren't a con man in the 1960s, which is a similar time to Frank Abagnale, then you really were a bit of a mug, because it was just so easy to get by people.
You could just go anywhere.
But then I was like, well, that's like if you're a hacker now, then you're a mug, because there's all sorts of ways to get around the computer.
And you can, like, if you don't care, you could get in loads of places. You could just walk through stuffed doors. Like, yeah, I'm sure you could wander around. Yeah. Loads of places the public don't go.
And then I just thought, well, actually, what I'm basically saying is just, if you're smart, you can do good things. Yeah. And then I realised I was drunk and gave up for the night. So the rest of the research took place the following day. So he'd got onto past security, airport security. It said that in the article, he got past airport security and onto the runway, but I would think it'd be more likely to just get on the runway from a different angle. You don't need to go through security to...
Yeah.
But he did. And then he hid himself inside the cargo part.
I thought you'd say inside a suitcase.
No. It was a sort of cargo airliner, I think, a BOAC 707 airliner. And from there, he stayed hidden throughout the entire flight to New York in a space that was about the size of a coffin. So just squidged in. That would have been, I mean, was it still as fast back then? 8 hours flight, maybe? 6 hours, something like that?
Yeah. They can't go much slower. They'll fall out the sky.
True. So the plane landed at Kennedy Airport, but immigration officials caught him and then returned him to his parents.
Yeah.
He was obviously pleased with the adventure, because then he tried it again the next year.
And the next day.
Yeah. So again, he managed to stow away in a cargo plane. This one was a Pan American plane that was headed for Pennsylvania. Although, once again, when he got there, police were able to apprehend him on his arrival.
Isn't it really dangerous travelling with the cargo, though? Because it gets really cold, because obviously it's not heated.
Yeah.
And that's how people... There was a person who fell out of the plane and survived, wasn't there? That people were trying to stow away.
Well, if it's not packed, what if it's all, like, rolling around? I guess they maybe do things to stop it rolling around.
But it's supposed to get really cold and it's really noisy. Yeah. Like, a lot of pets die, I think, that are transported, because it's the stress and the cold and...
Well, they haven't brought this up, but maybe being trapped in those aeroplanes for so long is what sent him a bit doolally.
Maybe.
I'm going to say so. It's basically sensory deprivement.
Yeah.
Except the sense is freezing. But yeah, he received loads of positive reinforcement for this. He was featured in newspapers, and like there's a photograph from the newspaper article where they have him posing with a stewardess, like giving her a kiss, as if like he was some dashing hero. Like they loved this story.
Brilliant.
It was thought at the time that even though his parents were despairing of his adventures, that at least he had a really specific skill set that he could put to use in later life, and that, you know, he could go on to be like a military spy or something. But his mental state was proving to be really fragile, and his childhood antics then later, they were like, oh, that was probably a sign that he was a little bit dangerous. So there aren't many details about what happened with his next major crime. It took place in 1970. But I think you'll probably be glad when you know what it was. He was 17 years old when Stephen Wilkins was convicted of the rape of an 80-year-old woman.
Oh, I was thinking it would be saving puppies or something. Like, no. You'll love it.
He went really gross, really fast.
Of how old?
17, and the woman was 80.
So, yeah, that's just a power thing, isn't it? That's just an easy target. Oh, God.
But at this trial, they recognised that he was seriously disturbed.
Yeah.
So he was sent to Rampton Prison. Well, it's a high-security psychiatric hospital. It's in Nottinghamshire. And it held some really famous criminals. Beverly Allitt was there. Ian Huntley was there. And I have a source of a source of a source who...
You have an in.
Well, I don't want to say who it is because they might get in trouble, but I haven't spoken to them directly. But someone I know has an auntie who works in the kitchens at Rampton Hospital and has done for years and years and years. And
Can we put exclusive on this episode then?
No. I want them to get in contact with them, like, oh, we don't really speak to that side of the family anymore. I'm like, no, come on, I need an interview with this woman. So basically, this hospital, obviously it has people who aren't criminals, but it has some of the most dangerous criminals. Really the highest need, it's on par with Broadmoor. And if anything, it has had worse criticisms about its treatment of patients there. So she says that there's some really long-standing residents there who've absolutely got no hope of recovery. They've just been there their whole lives. And it's just, where do you put the people that are beyond anything? And she also said that there's lots of people who have come in for like slight infractions, and you've seen them go on a massive decline as soon as they've gone in, and now they've got no hope. Apparently there's one example of a guy who was caught looking through someone's living room window, so they were labeled a peeping Tom and sent to Rampton, and then because of the conditions in there, their mental state has just deteriorated, whereas now they're acting as bad as some of the worst case patients there now.
Because that's pretty minor.
Yeah, and they were obviously living a normal life, but now they're just beyond rehabilitation.
Oh, that's messed up.
Apparently there's lots of escape attempts made quite often. This person, like I said, worked in the kitchens, says that like where the entrance, where the workers come in, there's been occasions where patients have been able to get to that sort of area and like jump on people as they're coming in to try and get out and things. It sounds quite frightening, and it has improved apparently massively since the 70s. But even really recently, there was an article in the, I think it was the Independent, which was saying about how people have been locked in rooms like naked for days and days and days. They just have food. like had food put through a hatch. Like they had no facilities because they were locked in this room because of their behaviour with no sanitary facilities at all. So they're just naked in their own filth. That's was this foul. One case that was told about in The Independent, but I think in the 70s it was a similar thing. So horrendous treatment there. They were just, I think, to in their defence, like in those sorts of places, like a lot of the NHS, funding is really, really stretched and you're working with the highest need patients, really physically demanding job. And if you don't have the resources to help them, sometimes the last resort is to...
Well, if they're going to use anything as a weapon or on themselves, I guess if you take everything away, but it is just a... Okay, what do we do? We'll just do this for a bit, but then you've got to come up with a plan.
Exactly, because that's what they're saying. There was complaints about how sparse the rooms were and they were like cells. But then they're saying, well, we have to make them completely like suicide, self-harm proof. Yeah. There can't be anything in there. So that's why they end up... So it's a really tricky situation just because of the high need that they're dealing with. So similarly for Wilkins, when he was there, he threatened workers and he attempted to escape. But I think perhaps because of his age, they felt like he's someone that we can maybe make a difference with, and effort was put into rehabilitating him. He was apparently put on some medication and his family complained because they said they could see him getting worse. So they took him off the medication because of it. But then he was sent to the rehabilitation unit called Balderton, and it wasn't a short process because it was 9 years later when he was starting to... They were like, okay, we're thinking you're about ready. They sent him for a weekend visit home to his parents in Grimsby. That went really well. So 1979, that same year, he was continuing to show improved behaviour. So they said, right, we're thinking about permanent release, so we'll give you 2 weeks leave to go home and see how you cope. Try and get a job, try and get settled, and then...
That's good. Is that what... Was it Graham Young who had the same and then he murdered someone in that time?
Yep.
Yeah.
Shit. It's going to be very soon.
Oh, God.
So around this exact same time that he was being released for 2 weeks, Yorkshire TV were making a documentary called The Secret Hospital. It came in two parts and it had interviews with workers, inmates, former inmates, and it sort of was exposing the darker side of mental health care. And this was a really seminal documentary. It's on loads of lists as like the top 10 documentaries that changed Britain and things. But bizarrely, it's you can't find it anywhere. No. I think you would have to write to Yorkshire TV to get a copy of it. There was a recent, there's a more modern one about Rampton, but it doesn't really go much into the history of it. It's more about what it's like today. There is it, I watched another programme on Cropsey. I think they show footage of the mental hospital over in America in a similar sort of time. And that's really disturbing footage. And I think it's probably quite similar. So Wilkins was actually interviewed for this documentary and he complained of the poor standards of living and brutal treatment by staff to the patients, and he was not the only person to do so. And this documentary went on, it won an international Emmy and it sparked national debate and they were pushing for reform. So it was a big deal when this came out. Again, this came out, he's on TV just at the time that he's released. And later, some criminologists, this Professor John Cohen, he said that the inclusion of these inmate interviews was potentially very dangerous. And he described the documentary as being, quote, unwise action of screening individuals who are exhibitionists and psychopaths. And thought, like, with the media attention that surrounded him as a teenager when he went on to commit his crime, there's some who believe that this documentary then sparked him to go on to do what he did next.
So it's the TV's fault.
Well, that's what they say, but I think the 10 years he spent, 9 years he spent in a psychiatric institution probably added to it. So on the very last day of his fortnight's leave, he'd had a good week, he'd got lined up a job with a decorator for when he got out, and the very last day he went to visit a distant relative who had been kind enough to send him care packages and food parcels while he was in Rampton. She was affectionately known by many of the Grimsby locals as Polish Marie. But 68-year-old Marie Jensen She was born in the UK in Whitehaven. She had no obvious links to Poland.
What?
Yeah, no one really knew how she got the nickname.
Do you think she used to do a lot of polishing and then someone mispronounced it?
Or maybe if you went round for dinner, the soup was always cold. What is this? Borscht? I don't know. Did you have borscht in?
We didn't go to, because everywhere that sold Polish food was just meat and potatoes. And obviously can't eat meat, so we sort of had a curry.
No pierogies.
We had some Thai food.
Nice. So she was well known for acts of kindness, because as well as she was sending these packages to Stephen Wilkins, she would also, a couple of weeks before, she'd taken a lot of clothes to this couple. She read in the newspaper that their home had been burnt down, and so she just went round and took them loads of clothes. Aww. So a nice older lady. So according to the information at trial later, Marie Jensen had been painting a ceiling on the night of June the 14th, 1979, when Wilkins came by to see her. He was invited in for a cup of tea, and then he began to try and turn the conversation to sex. He was sort of flattering her, and eventually he asked if he could stay the night. So when his advances were flatly rejected by Mrs. Jensen, he became angry. And with an arm around her neck, he strangled her until she eventually passed out. So Wilkins then began to undress her, but while doing so, Mrs. Jensen regained consciousness and begged for her life. And Wilkins told her that he wasn't going to kill her, but he did take her upstairs to the bedroom where he raped her.
Oh my God.
Afterwards, she was obviously still incredibly frightened for his life, because she knew why he was, why he'd gotten, like she'd been sending packages to his hospital, so she knew what kind of potential he had to be dangerous. So she tried to reassure Wilkins that she wasn't going to tell anyone, I'm not going to report what happened, like I won't say a word. And it's thought that until this moment, Wilkins hadn't really considered the consequence of committing this act so close to his release. And then when she said, oh, don't worry, I won't tell anyone, he realised that...
She could tell someone.
Yeah, and that if there was evidence of this, he was going to go straight back, not to the Boulderton, but he'd be right back to Rampton Hospital, and this time without any hope of rehabilitation, because he'd just proved them wrong. So completely determined not to return, Wilkins used his hands to strangle Marie Jensen to death. Then, knowing that he had to remove any physical evidence, he then set fire to the bed and left the house. Only later to ask a taxi driver to take him back to the street so he could watch what happened next.
He's really messed up, isn't he?
Very seriously. So there's a passing police officer who first noticed smoke coming from Mrs. Jensen's house. And firefighters broke in and removed her body. And they thought it must be smoke inhalation, so sent her off to hospital. And at Grimsby General, she was pronounced dead on arrival. Then at the autopsy, they noticed the contusions on her neck, and police knew they had to find a murderer. So Wilkins was known to be on leave, obviously from Britain's highest security hospital, so he was immediately the prime suspect, and his description was circulated throughout the country. So Wilkins, meanwhile, had gone to great lengths to evade capture. He stole a camper van from Grimsby Docks and headed for Scotland. With him was a 17-year-old girl who, due to her age at the time, as there's her name's not...
So he just picked up some 17-year-old.
Said there's like she was a friend of his or a lady friend. He's only been out of hospital for like two weeks.
Yeah.
But he's early 20s. He was in the 70s sort of style, I guess, quite good looking.
I mean, I guess you could have like, you could be dating someone for a week.
Yeah, and he was like, come on an adventure with me. He was a grown man, 17-year-old girl, probably. He wouldn't, I'm sure he didn't tell her where he'd been.
No.
So... It was a few days after the murder, on the 18th of June now, Wilkins and his young acquaintance had made their way north as far as Berwick-on-Tweed, and they were required to stop at Coldstream petrol station. So Wilkins left the girl in the van, and he went inside saying, oh, I'm just going to go and buy a map. And working behind the counter was 63-year-old Sidney Mowat. So not much is known about what occurred next. Most likely, I think the simple fact is just that Wilkins didn't have any money to pay for what he needed. But whatever occurred in there, Wilkins stabbed Sidney to death and left him just on the counter.
Oh my God.
He then stole the contents of the till, £89, and drove off. Don't know if he got the map or not. It didn't matter because he didn't get a chance to go far. They got about less than a mile away when, luckily for everyone in Berwick-on-Tweed, he got a flat tyre and the camper van had to stop. Then, this isn't the first time a nosy farmer has saved the day. A nosy farmer noticed this camper van with this guy, thought it was suspicious, and called the police. Like, I'm sure we've had that before. Yeah. It was like a farmer just noticed someone they hadn't seen before.
We had that with the double act going around Scotland as well, who painted their car weird. And
yes,
someone called
and the hotel owner, they just asked for a room. And they're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to ring the police. But this farmer thought, they look odd.
There's a few civilians who've acted who've solved a case.
Yeah, just, I guess, ring the police if you are concerned.
Yeah.
Better than going home and saying, I saw something weird today.
I guess, but then if I saw a car where I didn't normally see a car, I don't think I'd think to call.
Yeah.
I've seen
weird stuff.
That's
true, and it depends what you think a suspicious person looks like.
I've seen weird stuff and not done anything and thought, I wondered if it was something.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should be calling the police more.
Well, the officers were able to arrive before they'd gone anywhere. So Wilkins just ran off and he dived into the River Tweed to try and escape. I thought he might have died. He didn't, but he was caught almost immediately. And so he was just straight away charged with Cindy Mowat's murder. By October, he'd gone to trial and been jailed for life. 5 months into his life sentence in 1980, he was still only 27 years old. Wilkins then was once again in court. This time it was on the murder charge of Marie Jensen. He did admit to the murder, the rape and the arson. But at the hearing, his defence were trying to mitigate the circumstances and show that it was due to this extreme cruelty at Rampton that pushed him to murder because he just couldn't face going back there. The judge refused to listen to any claims of mistreatment, saying, quote, I'm not going to let this court be used for airing any grievances he might have against the authorities. So Wilkins was sentenced to a life sentence for rape, a life sentence for murder, and 10 years for the arson. And they were all going to run concurrently, which means at the same time.
I hate concurrent.
What's the point?
Yeah.
He seemed pleased with the outcome because they were to serve in a general prison, not back at Rampton. So they're all concurrent. So it's one life sentence. He's already done one, pretty much. One life sentence in a normal prison. So he was like, that's a breeze compared to where I've been. In a bizarre twist of fate, 20 years later, so 2000, Wilkins' father, Alfred, was accused of indecent assault against a 9-year-old girl. Now, he was cleared completely of all three counts, so found totally innocent. But when these things happen, not everyone believes it, do they? Even though he's innocent, just the fact that it had been in the papers and his name had been released meant that the group of vigilantes took it upon themselves. They thought he'd escaped justice and they were going to give it back to him.
I mean, you've got to... I know the system isn't great always, but you've got to sort of trust in it to some extent so that you don't start hounding an innocent person.
Yeah, so his windows were regularly smashed in, graffiti on his flat, calling him a nonce, pedo, etc. It's reported that he made over 80 phone calls to police saying that he needed help, that people were being violent, threatening to him. In February 2001, this just continued because then he's just the local pedo, like people were just targeting him constantly. So in 2001, the violence escalated and a couple of intruders broke into the 67-year-old's house and seriously beat him up. He was left really badly injured. And then it was only about a week later that turpentine was poured through his letterbox and set on fire. And then, obviously, because his windows are constantly smashed in, so they're all boarded up, which pretty much made him trapped inside.
Oh, my God.
And he died from smoke inhalation.
Oh, that's horrid.
Yep.
So did anyone go to prison for that?
Well, The following year, two men were charged with the murder. They were found guilty and they both received life sentences. But even weirder, 9 years later, one of the convictions was overturned because apparently there was some psychological evidence showing that one of the men had made a false confession.
Oh, to the arson?
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird.
Said that he had a pathological need for attention. But you'd have thought if there were two of them that the other one would have said he wasn't involved.
Yeah.
But then you see that all the time, like the West Memphis Three. There was only one saying they were there and two saying they wasn't. Mm. And it didn't really matter, did it? True. Once someone's admitted, they're just like, why would you admit it if it's not true?
Yeah.
So, still not the end of the story. By 2014, so now 61 years old, Stephen Wilkins was serving his time and he was at North Sea Camp Open Prison in Lincolnshire. So he'd obviously been doing pretty well to have been moved to an open prison.
Is that where you can go out in the community?
I think so, yeah. Wow. He's obviously, I think maybe the routines and the lack of intense bad treatment probably actually really helped settle in that you know exactly what's happening, when it's going to happen, it's the same all the time. So I think someone like him can feel quite safe in that sort of environment. On the 14th of June, however, I keep hitting the microphone, sorry, I'll say it again. On the 14th of June, however, he was not present for the evening roll call. So a search began and Wilkins was soon spotted just outside the prison boundary. So he hadn't really gone.
He was just standing there waving.
He wasn't really running away. He was just like outside. When officers spotted him, he then jumped over a fence into a rapeseed field where the yellow flowers perfectly camouflaged against the waterproofs he had on. And it took about half an hour for him to be finally brought out by officers. And Wilkins just said, I went for a walk and then I fell asleep in the field.
Well, when we were chasing you, yeah, that shows us not true.
Of course it wasn't. No one believed him and he was convicted of absconding custody. But I just feel like, he was coming up for release soon in two years.
He didn't want to be released.
I think so. Because he'd done really well. He'd not been at, most of his life he'd been most of his life he'd been in an institution.
Yeah.
He'd only been out as a child and even then he'd been doing weird fucking things. He knew if he did anything really bad, he'd get sent maybe to a psychiatric hospital. Whereas this seems perfect.
And I guess if you know the people, you know the staff.
Yeah.
You've been through much worse. You've been in much worse places.
So he was given 4 weeks to run concurrently with his sentence, so it doesn't really make much difference.
No.
But the difference it made was that he wouldn't be considered for release then. Okay. He was coming up in 2 years and it's not going to be thought of now because you're obviously a flight risk. And I do think that's probably what he wanted.
Mm.
It was all in vain anyway. By 2016, when he would have been due for release, it was found that Wilkins had lung cancer and he actually died on April 4th in hospice.
He did a lot of bad stuff.
He did a lot of bad things, but a lot of bad things happened to him too. It's one of those complicated ones. He raped and murdered old women.
Yeah. No, it's not excusable though, is it?
It's not excusable. It's why he was in prison all his life.
Yeah.
There you go.
Happy Halloween.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, so my story is about Heather Stevenson Snell. And I got a lot of the information from a book called Women Who Kill by Vanessa Howard, which I got on the Kindle for 99p.
Nice.
That's pretty good. So Heather was born in 1957 in Malta.
You know everyone's going to start their own podcast now.
Yeah, there's about 5 other stories in that book.
That's it. They're going to be like, oh, we're called Slaying.
Her father was a soldier in the British Army, so they were living in Malta, and she moved around quite a lot in her childhood. So she found this pretty hard, as anyone would, really, just because it's difficult to make friends. And sort of at that age, you're kind of, all you want is a group of mates, isn't it? So to add to this, age 7, her parents divorced. So she moved with her mum and her brother to Canada.
Well, Malta's not fun. When I went to Mini Europe, which is the greatest place on earth in Brussels, the Malta section was crap.
Really?
That's what I'm basing my judgment on.
So, in Canada, her mum didn't really settle. She didn't really like it. So they were there for a few years. But then her mother took them all back to the UK when Heather was about 13. So she was initially sent to a boarding school in Kent. I mean, this mum did not want to spend time with her. No. So she went, sent her straight off to boarding school. Heather didn't enjoy it. They took the piss out of her accent. And I guess it was a combination of sort of Canadian and Maltese. And
it'd have been all over the shop. Yeah. It'd be like Kelly Osbourne's, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
What the fuck is that?
Kids are mean as well, because when I, there's a kid with an accent at my school, everyone always... Take the mick a little bit. Obviously, I tell them off.
Very xenophobic.
Yeah. Like, what? No matter what accent, even if it's a cool one, they're still like...
You're different.
Yeah. So she went to live with an aunt in Scarborough. She wasn't getting on with her mum. She didn't like boarding school. And she didn't really speak to her father anymore, who was still in Malta. So in order to make friends, Heather had a tactic. So she began to lie. So she told everyone that her dad was a spy, and that he worked for a secret agency, and that's why he wasn't around. But then she didn't stick to it, so she told some other people that he was a famous writer and author. So she was just bullshitting all over the place. So she was there for a few years. At 16, she did really badly in her exams. She wasn't really that bothered. She began to commit petty theft, and she began drinking quite heavily as well. After being in court a few times, she was basically on her last warning. They said, look, you're young, we don't want to send you to prison, but if you keep doing this, this is the way it's going to go. So right. It's sort of like last chance saloon at this point. And at this point, she met Leo Snell. Now, he sort of changed it a little bit for her. He owned a bookshop and he was advertising for someone to work there, and she applied and quickly began working there. He was a bit older than her, but I don't think he was sort of creepy older. And they began dating quite quickly.
Okay.
So within months...
I mean, he owns a bookshop. That's a step up for her.
Yeah. I think she just liked working there. She got on with him. I mean, there is a pattern of any man that she seems to spend any time with, they start dating and shagging, and it sort of turns sexual quite quickly. So
right.
There's obviously some behaviour there.
I think it's called daddy issues.
Probably. So within months, they were married and they had a baby on the way. So they moved to Penrith, which is like nice village near the Lake District.
Yeah, it's cute.
Yeah.
there you go. That's my TripAdvisor review. Yeah, it's cute.
So Heather's marriage became quite difficult. She you'll see a pattern of her quickly getting into relationships, but then also them not working out. So her and Leo separated. But this time...
She kept that name, though.
Well, she added it on the end. So Heather Stevenson Snell. I mean, I can hardly talk. That's a joke just for us.
Yeah.
So this time, she had a different attitude, though. So she sort of, instead of going back to the life that she had, she sort of kept it a bit and then did a lot of good stuff. So she enrolled an Open University course. She did very well in this. And I know that for sort of single parents and people on low incomes, I think they offer a lot of courses for free as well.
I don't see the bad in this. Like, she had a pretty... She had a quite emotionally neglectful childhood.
Yeah.
She's had a divorce. She's got a kid. She's trying to sort her shit out.
She did really well at Open University, and then she got her qualifications. So she wanted to challenge herself more. So she applied for York University.
Sounds great.
Now, she got accepted.
I'm sure if she murdered someone, they deserved it.
Well, so.
Was it, unless it was a kid, was it a kid?
No, it wasn't a kid.
See, they probably deserved it.
They definitely didn't.
Oh.
So she was accepted onto York University course to do psychology. The same year she got accepted, she did get in trouble again for theft. So she's sort of a bit of the old and a bit of the new with Heather. So she went on, she completed the degree. She did go to York. They still had her. And then once she completed her degree in psychology, she sort of thought, what can I do now? So she did what?
Yes.
Because what can you do?
Exactly.
She decided she would go into counselling. Now, a lot of people think that psychology is effectively sort of therapy and counselling. It's definitely not. They're completely different. And a degree in psychology does not make you a trained counsellor.
No.
But anyone can set themselves up as a counsellor.
Can you really?
Yeah. So you, because she had...
Because I quite fancy a bit of that, you know.
Yeah, because she had like... York University psychology degree, everyone went, yeah, brilliant, she's definitely going to be a really good counsellor, and signed up with her. I think she was all right, but she was
It is
also
a different skill set, though. It's a very...
Yeah, it's different. It's really different. So she set up her own practice, and she called herself a psychotherapist. She offered sort of help with stress, smoking, and this is how I know it's a bit bullshit, past life regression.
Oh, there we go.
Even though her psychology...
Yeah, but that's so fun, though. You know, if you could just be pretending like, oh, what do you see? An Egyptian. Great! Like,
you're Cleopatra.
Yeah.
So, but this is surprising because her psychology degree was really a scientific one. It wasn't sort of a humanities one. There's two sort of schools of thought on that. So she did like a science degree. But she went into this sort of, I don't know, like there's an array, isn't there? So arguably she wasn't really trained for this role, but she did quite well, and she did write some articles about psychometric testing that she was using. So, like, you know, there's like a Beck came up with a scale of that's linked to depression, and she sort of commented on that in an article and wrote some quite high caliber stuff. So she understood what she was doing.
Okay.
And was fairly insightful.
Snell is doing swell. I am still not convinced.
Now, outside of her work, she had somewhat of a double life. She took drugs. She drank heavily. She collected knives and machetes.
Oh.
And she joined a
women's... There we go.
She joined a women's biker club. Now, to be fair, this women's biker club...
It's only the knives and machetes. Oh, and the drugs.
Yeah.
Really.
The women's biker club, it didn't seem like it was sort of... Do you know, a lot of biker clubs are linked to organised crime, and they're
are
sort
they?
Of like a... naughty group that understating, isn't it? There's like the Hell's Angels and
are
stuff.
They crime?
Yeah.
No, I thought they like helped people. In my mind, a Hell's Angel is a group of like motorcycle dudes. They're like a ride or die gang, and if they see shit on the road that they don't agree with, they're like, we'll step in. I thought they were like roadside vigilantes.
Nah, I think they're more like, we're gonna fuck you up if you don't let us eat your food for free in this restaurant.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Why aren't they just...
If you know anything about actual motorcycle groups, give us a tweet, let us know. Are they
when
good or bad?
When I worked at the pub and we did bike and trike night, they were lovely bikers that came round.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I had this impression that they were...
Into crime! I thought the Hell's Angel was like, we look scary, but we're nice.
Yeah, but I think that's every bit of film or TV that has included a biker has tried to flip it and be like, oh, they seem so nasty, and actually this one's really nice. But I think it's been done so much
that I've just absorbed it.
The impression is that they're all really nice.
I don't know enough bikers.
So she was in the biker club, but I think it was just a load of women
riding bikes.
Riding bikes. So 2002, Heather put out an advert for a dog sitter. She had two...
Was it for a kid?
She had two Rottweilers.
Oh, great.
So she went for the scariest looking animals. I think Rottweilers are actually really nice dogs.
Can you imagine this psychotherapist? She's a fucking badass. Like, you show up and she's there.
They're
like,
in leather and a Rottweiler.
I wanted to be sat in like a winged armchair with a Rottweiler either side, just stroking them.
Like. Yeah. So she put his advert, and what she wanted was, I thought she wanted a dog sitter, but in reality, what she wanted was someone to live in her house and walk her dogs. So really, she wanted a husband. Live-in
dog sitter.
She wanted a husband to do the chores, but he kind of has to, I guess. So a guy called Adrian Sinclair applied for this job. Now, he was a bit of a roamer around, and he, although this was a weird job, he'd done all sorts. He'd been like a decorator, but he's been like, not like a stripper, like an actual stripper. So he'd done a bit of this, bit of that, didn't have anywhere to live. So for him, he's like, brilliant, live in a nice house, walk some dogs, happy days.
Yeah.
So he was well up for it, but within weeks, they'd started shagging.
Okay.
Sort of like the bookshop all over again. So I guess he thought...
The bookshop, but with more dog hair.
Yeah. I guess he thought he was onto a good thing because she seemed quite sweet. She was well-educated. She was a psychotherapist.
Yeah, if you're into it, that sounds really cool.
But then she started... sort of breaking that mold. She showed him the guns that she had. She was like, here's where I party with my biker friend, here's all the drugs that we take. And she said to him, if people cross me, I don't take it and I'll attack them. And she said that she'd done this before, so it didn't necessarily put him off, but he was maybe a little bit suspicious. But it did,
maybe he liked that.
Well, it did sort of erode away at their relationship, and it didn't last that long. So they had this really intense relationship, and then it began to fall apart. And eventually she said to him, this is weird, but I'm going to New York for 3 months on like a writing course, and I want you to leave the house.
Because her career doesn't stop.
She's got a kid.
Do not get in her way. She's going to New York for a writing course, and you will stay with the dogs, and my child will go to boarding school, and I will get shit done.
Well, she asked him to leave.
Yeah, she hasn't got time for his shit in her life. Like, stop dragging me down, moaning about my guns.
She's not putting those dogs in kennels.
I am pulling the trigger on this New York trip.
So she goes to New York, he moves out, and then they're still talking, they're still having sexy conversations over the phone. But
I love that you're like, ew, I don't even want to say phone sex.
Never done it.
I guess they're sort of sexy phone conversations.
I don't think I'd be good at that.
No,
it's so awkward. But so he tells her he started seeing someone new, and she is not fucking happy, so she starts going a bit mad. So she starts sending abusive messages to Adrian, abusive messages to his new girlfriend. She finds out his name. She contacts all his friends, starts making up stories about things that he'd done to her. This is when she'd come back. She'd call up his new girlfriend called Diane, and she'd call her a slag, she'd call her a hooker. And Adrian went round, now he didn't help the situation. So he went round to see Heather and basically said, look, you've got to leave her alone. You've got to stop this. This is, you know, this is too much. But he ended up having sex with Heather when he's around there. So obviously she's getting mixed messages from him then. And she thinks, all I've got to do is get rid of Diane and we can be together.
I bet she had a name for her vagina. Like, I just get the impression that she's the sort of woman who's like, you need to talk to the Iron Lady or something like that.
What was it that you called it? Axe wound?
Battle crease.
Battle crease.
She's got a fucking battle crease.
So she is constantly calling Diane. She's constantly calling Adrian. She's watching them. She's harassing them. So they move away, but she gets their numbers. She gets their address, and she starts sending photos of Diane's children. So Diane's freaking out now. Heather phoned social services saying that Diane was abusing her children. So she goes deep, right?
She's lost it now.
Yeah. And this is all while she's working as a psychotherapist and giving people advice on their lives.
I mean, if there's one thing we can't falter on, it's her career choices.
Imagine getting advice from her, though.
What you need to do, get some photographs of their children and blackmail them.
If he breaks up with you, you just set fire to their fucking house.
Right.
Right? So Adrian continues to stay with Diane. He has chosen her, but their relationship is suffering and it's a struggle. I mean, you've got to really want to be with someone if you're going through this level of torment. So he moves out. They stay as a couple, but he doesn't live with Diane and her kids anymore. And even though it's really obvious they're still in a relationship, he's going around most evenings. And if she's really stalking them, she'd know this. Heather backs off and they think, brilliant, it's fixed, it's fine. We'll just won't ever live together. So it appears that she's backed off. What she's really doing is booking herself into a clay pigeon shooting class so she can learn how to shoot guns. Because even though she's got a load, she hasn't even shooting them. She's never shot them.
Ooh.
So she books this class. The guy is like, oh yeah, you're really interested in clay pigeon shooting. She's like, no, I just want to learn how to use the gun. So she's sort of excited about that. And then she's like,
can you put a wig on the clay pigeon?
Yeah, call it Diane. So then she sets about a plan to kill Diane and frame Adrian for the murder. So that's her end goal. So
how the fuck is she going to frame him for the murder? Anyone who knows them will know that you've been harassing them.
But she's not a clever woman.
Well,
she is a clever woman. That's the weird thing.
Thank you.
But she's not.
She's not using her rational brain at this point. Yeah.
So she writes a list of the items. Basically, she decides to carry out this murder on Halloween. And they found in her house a list. Now, as far as I can see, she didn't actually use any of these, well, most of these items, but she bought a black bag, a Barbie mini skirt, practical shoes, but ladylike, pink or blue
a
wig.
A Barbie mini skirt as in a mini skirt for a Barbie, or a mini skirt for her that was Barbie themed?
I think it must be Barbie themed. Pink or blue wig, either one, black PVC coat, Matrix, thick Barbie tights and pink gloves. I think her plan was to go out in a costume.
So she looked like a man dressed as a up. Is that why?
I don't know.
She wanted them to think it was him.
I think she just maybe wanted to not be spotted.
Not be spotted?
I know. She's a grown woman. Looking
like Dominatrix Barbie.
I don't know. Anyway, it's not what she wore. But what she did as well, she also hid bikes at like friends' houses around, although I don't understand why, because she literally just drove to the house. And she got some items of clothing that used to belong to Adrian, and she wore them, and then she put a white sheet over and drew like a ghost face on top so no one could see that she's wearing these clothes underneath. But again, it's not a clever idea because her DNA is going to be all over those clothes.
Can you imagine dressing up in like the sort of clothes that you're left with from an ex-boyfriend? To be fair, they're quite good. Usually the sort of clothes you're left with are like hoodies, joggers.
Yeah.
Like.
But her DNA is going to be all over them anyway if she's knocking around wearing them.
And he's not been with her for ages, so she's probably been wearing them all the time.
Yeah. So then she also took a screamer mask. Like from the film Scream, and then a shotgun, and then she had a bike helmet with her, and she drove to Diane and Adrian's house. What, Diane was living there. So she arrived and she banged on the door and no one answered. I think Diane probably looked through the people and went, yeah, that's not going to happen.
So she was wearing the ghost sheet and the Scream mask.
I think so.
So it can be like Scooby-Doo when they pull the mask off. It's like, it's still a ghost.
Yeah, maybe.
I like that. That's a clever idea. Double mask. Okay.
So no one answered the door. I think you don't. I mean, it was like 11 o'clock midnight. Mm. It was ridiculous.
And did you say it was Halloween too? So you think it was some shitty trick-or-treaters?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in Milan, all the kids, they just trick-or-treat around the shops.
Really?
Yeah, like, because everyone lives in flats, so they're
like
all just
an
like...
iPhone Apple store.
Yeah, no, literally, they're all just going down the high street and the shops would have sweets for them or they'd give them other things because we were in this focaccia shop at the time and like, so they were just like chopping up like little chunks of nice yummy focaccia.
That's
and give it
cute.
To the kids. I was like, I want this.
Oh.
Carry on.
So no one answered the door. So she continued to knock loudly. So after a few minutes, a neighbour called Bob Wilk, who used to be a soldier, and he's pretty badass, And he's staying with his fiance who lives next door. So he opens the door and basically he says to this person, why are you making so much noise? Obviously they're not in, just fuck off home. And they begin arguing, and then Diane hears this, and I think she's probably been behind the door the whole time, because then she opens it, because I think she thinks, well, at least if Bob's here, we can confront her together, or whoever this is, I can find out who it is, but I'm safe now.
Yeah.
So Bob goes to grab Heather's mask, and as he does, she shoots him in the torso.
Oh.
And he falls back, and a neighbour calls 999. So she just leaves. She walks off, returns to her car, and drives away. And within an hour, she's pulled over by police and arrested because...
she's wearing a ghost face.
Yeah. And, like, they can track the car, you know, it's not that difficult to find out.
Everyone knew it would be her.
Well, yeah. So it's a crap murder. And she didn't even get the person that she was going for. Poor Bob Wilk, completely innocent bystander.
Yeah,
just trying to do the right thing. So it's just a mess.
And he was obviously just, like, thinking... this is ridiculous. I'm just going to see who you are. Like, he was trying to be, he was being really brave and just like trying to sort it out.
Yeah.
It was really sad.
Horrific. So, Heather went on trial in September 2004. And Adrian Diane, ironically, ended their relationship at this point. I think it was just too much for it.
It's a lot to go through.
Yeah.
I mean, Diane must be feeling horrendous as well. Like, you'd get serious survivor's guilt and.
Awful. Bob, the victim, was spoken about as a wonderful, loving fiancé, brother, really great guy. And then Heather Stevenson Snell received 22 years for Bob's murder, and she also had concurrent sentences. So she had Diane's attempted murder and charges for stalking. So she's still in prison now. So, yeah, happened on Halloween, but an absolute... ridiculous
shocker, that.
Yeah.
Let's not blame the bikers for it until I get more information.
Yeah.
I need to look into bikers.
Maybe we can do a biker gang next week.
Involved in... I don't know that they are. Because don't you just get together because you like riding bikes and like... isn't it like...
I'm sure they're dodgy.
I watched an episode of Four Weddings where she was like having a biker wedding and it was just like... they just had a barbecue. It was all very pleasant.
We need more information.
The same woman from the Four Weddings biker wedding was then on the Great Model Railway Challenge in a steampunk model railway challenge team. I think she just flits from like weird group to weird group so she can be on TV.
I think this is evidence that you're watching too much
reality
TV. I
love the Great Model Railway Challenge. It's insane. There are the highs are really fucking high. The lows are really low. This week's was really emotional because they were doing it for a team member who died and they were trying to support the club. Like, it's serious. Well, it's not about trains. It's like they have to model these huge layouts and build it and add animated elements. And will the train run on the track? You never know till the demonstration. Oh my God.
I bet it always does.
It's so good.
It sounds like
it's
shit.
It's so good. It's so good. There was huge drama the other week because Ray was missing and then he kept having cups of tea. They're like, Ray, what are you doing? He's like, I'm just having a brew. And they're like, you need to get the viaduct on now.
Oh my God.
It was so good. The viaduct was fine, but no one believed in Ray. I did.
Tell you what, that's about the amount of drama I want after a hard day.
I can't even tell you, it's brilliant. Right.
We haven't asked for this for a while, but can you stick us a review on iTunes, please?
I guess so.
5 stars. It will make a difference. We need to creep our way back.
Or just listen to us on Spotify, because we're on there now.
Yeah, I don't think we get any money for advertising then, though. So.
Oh, yeah, don't listen on Spotify.
If you've got a choice, do it somewhere else. You can donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/lotofthepod or podcast or something like that. Tweet us, Facebook us, tell us what you know about biker gangs.
Yep.
And if you've ever reported something weird to the police that solved a murder.
Ooh, let us know anything. Literally, tell me if you worked in Rampton. Tell me if you're in a biker gang. Tell me if you've ever solved a murder. Do some research and email it to me and I will credit you for the next week's episode.
Yeah, if you've got a lot to say, don't send it to Facebook Messenger.
Send it in an email. Write a lot. Write enough that I can speak for 20 minutes reading out your email and I'll be happy.
Slaughterthepodcast@gmail.com. Have a lovely week, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Take care.
Bye.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.